morning, everybody. So we're going to go back to what we were discussing in the shiur before this one, before we went off on that tangent about Mefursamos last week. And the question we were discussing is the mitzvah of emuna. The very last thing we mentioned was the critique of Rabbeinu Kreskes, who raised three challenges to the position of the Rambam that emuna is a mitzvah. And what we wanted to consider was how Rambam might respond to his challenge. So the first point that Rabbeinu Kreskes asked was that it doesn't really make sense that there be a mitzvah of emunah, that emunah be something that's commanded, because if someone already believes, the mitzvah is superfluous. And if they don't believe, then telling them to believe will not help. So I think we can consider two types of approaches to resolving this question. And they both lie in noting that the mitzvah of Anochi, which the Rambam is discussing, really goes, is relevant, is adding something for someone, even if they already believe. So, for example, the Avar Benel in Rosh Amanah, on chapter 7, and you have this in your source sheets, not from last week's shiur, but from the previous shiur, Rosh Amanah Perek Zayin, writes about, you see, Aval Kavana Sarav HaGadol B'chol Devarav Hu Sheha'ikar HaRishon VaMitzvah Rishona Hu Shenamin Shaloka Baruch Hu Far Yadanu Shehu Nimza Mitzyuso Hu Yoser Rishon Yoser Shalem Asher B'chol HaMitzyus Shemitzyuso Eino Efshar Mitzad Atzmo Ki Eser HaNimzayim Aval Hu Mechuyev HaMitzyus Mitzad Atzmo Bechula. Meaning to say, and the Abar Benel continues along these lines, is that it is not true that Anochi just says, believe in God. But as the Rambam explained at the very beginning of Hilchos Yisod HaTorah, and as we read in that first shiur, Anochi demands that we understand that God exists. He's a necessary existent. He's the source for all that exists. We don't just simply believe in God, but we try, to the extent possible, to understand what can be understood of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And certainly the basics of understanding, like his necessary existence, as the Rambam writes explicitly, are part of the mitzvah. So if Rabbeinu Kreskes asks on the Rambam, if you already believe in God, what's the point in the mitzvah? The answer is that's not true. I could believe in God, but not truly be fulfilling the mitzvah of Anochi, according to the Rambam. If, for example, I don't appreciate that he's a necessary existent, and the like, as the Abar Benel elaborates. Moreover, a number of thinkers add, including the Maram Shek and others in defending the Rambam, that it's not enough, or at least ideally, the mitzvah of Anochi demands that someone who already believes strengthen their belief, deepen their belief, that ideally, if our belief is predicated in proof and evidence and the like, that is a greater fulfillment of Anochi than someone who merely believes because they've been told to believe since they were a child. So this first school of thought, like we said, the Abar Benel, the Maram Shik, and others, all stress that Anochi demands much more than simple belief, and therefore it makes sense that Hashem would be mitzaveh, the mitzvah of Anochi, even for someone who already believes. A second type of approach perhaps could be found in the Sefer Derech Mitzvosecha, which you have over here right below the Abar Benel. This is written by Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, not the more famous one to you probably, but the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Rebbe of Lubavitch of Chabad. And he also has a book of mitzvos. And here he defends the Rambam by stressing that emuna or anochi is not just about believing in the existence of God or even the necessary existence of God. This is from the sources from 3 weeks ago, Shir. From not just the necessary existence of God, but that we have to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he exists in ways that can't be understood or intuited or proven. In other words, even if Rabbeinu Kreskes was right, well, that tells us there's no mitzvah of emunah to believe in something that can be proven. That's not emunah. That's simply following the conclusions of a logical argument. Emunah goes much further and is much deeper. It's a emotion that relates to our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's understanding that we can't understand him and the like. You have on your sources a a small piece of that. We discussed this also when we discussed the difference between the Rambam's usage of the word emunah versus the usage of the word yediyah and the like. So that is that relates to the first taina of Rabbeinu Kreskes. The second taina of Rabbeinu Kreskes is also addressed by the Rambam. And the question that Rabbeinu Kreskes asked was, is emunah voluntary? Meaning, say, a mitzvah has to be something that we can do, that's in our control, that's in our power. It doesn't make sense to demand, to command something beyond our ability, something that's not in our control. And therefore, Rabbeinu Kreskes said, how could emunah, how could belief, how could faith be a mitzvah? That's not something that a person controls. The Rambam addresses this in many places by emphasizing that a person does, in fact, have the ability to ascertain and to determine what's right in the realm of faith, and that naturally people may be drawn to false ideologies. Erroneous beliefs may be tempting, but a person is capable of searching honestly and arriving at the truth. Just to look at a couple of formulations in the Rambam, again, the next one in your source sheets, this is from Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Vav. Yediyas davar zeh mitzvah saseh, shenem anochi Hashem Elokecha, v'chol amala al daito, sheyesh am Eloha acher, chutz mizeh, over below saseh. In other words, a person has the ability to be mala al dato or not. We're going to see a lot more of this in the Rambam. The Rambam stresses in many places that there are mitzvos that demand of us to think in a clear way, not to be tempted by those things that bring us away from belief. And these have certain practical ramifications. For example, it's usher to study Sifrei Avodah Zarah or Sifrei Minos, at least, and even within the realm of Torah, a person has to go in order. You can't study philosophy, though it's a great mitzvah, before a person is ready. And a person, the Rambam says, and this is a point that we're not going to elaborate upon today, because I really want to stress another point, but the Rambam understands that a person does, in fact, to a large degree, have an ability to control and direct himself in this respect. And therefore, it does make sense to have a mitzvah of emunah. Now, yes?
even by emotions like Ava Nira, the Rambam says, I think that you
There are things that we can do that could promote Avanira, and there are things that we could do that could take us away from Avanira. It doesn't mean that I could just like turn on the spigot, wake up one morning and decide, okay, I hereby love Hashem and the like. So this is a bigger topic. And again, it's not today's topic, so I don't want to harp on it. But certainly, if the question is, this is something beyond our control, the answer for the Rambam is that this is to a large degree in our control. And perhaps another time we could talk about how and why and what that means. Just again, because I really do want to go on to today's topic, be Misayim with one Hara, which is that even though, as we saw, the Rambam and many other Rishonim stress the importance of seeking proof, and that Emuna ideally should be rooted in evidence and in proof, there were many who objected to this approach. Perhaps next week we'll talk about the Khuzari and what his objections are, but I think that we could isolate perhaps three reasons not to look for proof. Number one is more practical, which is, what if it doesn't work? If I go ahead and say, I'm going to look for proof for God, and then I don't succeed in finding proof, then my belief will be shattered, or at least weakened. Looking for proof, the act of searching for proof, is something that could lead to heresy. It's dangerous, certainly for someone who's not properly prepared or motivated. He might start and not stop. And therefore, one very important reason why there are many who object is this point. That could be on a fundamental level, or it could be on a practical level. Rav Elchanan Wasserman writes that, for example, even though there is a debate among Rishonim whether ideally proof should be rooted in, faith should be rooted in proof, writes that even though there are a number of Rishonim, like Rav Inuvachia, the Rambam who espoused this view, in an environment that's shchichi hazeka, as he puts it, they would agree that it's not advisable. And he argues that in our day and age, that the dangers are too great and it's a bad idea. That's one reason. Another reason is that it's too impersonal. We talked a little bit about this, I think, in the first year, but if a person goes ahead and, you know, has a proof for the existence of God, so their God is the conclusion of a proof, right? But there's no basis for a relationship. And again, we'll perhaps elaborate upon this next week. But it's not something that yields a relationship or even a very strong belief. The things that we know in our minds, in our heads, are oftentimes not the things that govern our actions. Person can know something is bad for them or unhealthy, and frequently they'll do it anyway. And therefore, at the very least, the root of emuna has to be something that's much, much deeper than simply a philosophical proof, even if someone succeeds in finding one. There's an interesting observation that you could see over here. It's made by the Chassid Yaivitz. You have it on your source sheets. The next source says Or Chaim. This is not the Or Chaim HaKadosh that perhaps you're more familiar with. This is written by Rav Yosef Yaivitz, the Chassid Yaivitz. He lived from 1440 to 1508, and he was one of the Grushei Sfarad. And he observes that when the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, among those who were put to the ultimate test those whose faith was rooted in philosophical proof, he compares that to someone who has a tree with many branches but shallow roots, failed. Whereas those who were ignorant, who he compares to someone with deep roots but shallow branches, they remained steadfast. They were willing to sacrifice for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Just take a look at his Lashon. Aleichem Ishim Ekra Migala Svarad Ani Asher Gurashnu Vavonosenu Arabim Vatsumim Verov Hamisparim Bechachma Vemaisin Tovim Kulam Hemiru Eskvodam Biomar Vanashim Ve'ame Haaretz Masru Gufam Umimonam Al Kedushas Boram. And Rav Huttner, actually, if you look in the next source, had an interesting insight. He says that's why we're taught to say Shema as a child, well before we could understand the philosophical implications of the verse. We read about a couple of weeks ago the Rambam's explanation of what Shema means, the absolute unity, the impossibility of having any type of attributions and the like. Well, before we could understand any of that, we say Shema. And that's because if our emuna is rooted in something that's so much deeper, of course, after you grow up, learn proofs, learn philosophy, learn more nevuchim, but the basis of the proof has to be rooted in something much deeper. Shutam lama shechozrin Shema Yisrael l'mayela dafka be'od shehutino. Shatfisa bekabalas omachu shemaim lo tiya mevuseses al havana sichlis greda. Ela al tashtis v'yesod hanefesh shehi begeder l'mala min haseichel. Now, a number of you asked after that shiur if we could spend a little bit of time talking about the position of the Rambam, the application of the Rambam, and proofs, and the like, in the modern world. Now, to be honest, I really don't like talking about this, because one would have to have a much stronger basis in philosophy, and modern philosophy, and science, than I have. But a number of you asked, so I think we'll try to do that a little bit today. That relates to the sheets that you got today. And I was also thinking of doing the following, maybe sometime before the end of the semester, having a Yom Iyun, and Rebbe Rothwax was okay with this, so we could do it the whole morning, in which people who are more experts than me address some of the questions and the challenges that people have in the modern context, whether it's from archaeology or biology or the like, different issues, different questions, how we can respond to these challenges and perhaps answering our own questions. So hopefully I will talk about that a little bit today, and this is something that we'll get back to. But again, I want to begin with that disclaimer that this is beyond my pay grade. But again, we'll try a little bit. So questions before we even start? Yeah.
Just about what you were just saying before about the emuna being rooted not in like
intellectual.
But could we potentially say that emuna should rather not be solely based on that, but like,
clearly, what he's arguing. It has to be both.
That it could be that you could have the foundation of the knowledge, and then, because, like, I'm thinking, like, in terms of, I mean, the only way I know how is, like, bringing it down to, like, people is, like, especially, like, when you're dating, right? You don't just say, I'm going to grow a relationship with this person. First, you date to test out to say, you need to prove for yourself to say, is this something that's going to actually happen that I can then form a relationship with?
Our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be, I mean, I wouldn't agree with your assessment of dating, but
that's fair.
but um, But it also may be, the Rambam at the end of Tochas Tshuva notwithstanding, that the cultivation of a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't the same as dating. You know, you try things out, go out for coffee, see if it works. If it does, you go on a second date. That's exactly what he's saying. And that our Mesorah Nemuna isn't that, okay, you know, when you're old enough to start really understanding these concepts, we'll introduce you to God and prove his existence philosophically, but rather the opposite, that we drink it in our mother's milk. And then as we grow up and become more sophisticated and are better able to understand, then we can deepen our faith by trying to understand what perhaps when we were young we couldn't understand, and looking for evidence and proof. Now again, what we're going to talk about next week is that one can object, as the Kuzari does, and say it's a very strange concept that you know, when you already strongly believe in something, to start then asking whether or not they exist. So
that works for someone who's a mammon, but someone who's not already.
Someone who isn't a mammon.
Question: someone who's that's shuva or someone who's converting. I think
all that is different, right?
Rooted in also,
of course, because there's no choice in that case. Meaning to say,
right,
there's a
difference. Only works, but then there's I guess I have the same thing with the Kuzaris. I guess
there's a difference between educational philosophy and how we are mechanich someone who grows up. When you have a child and you're from, and you want your child to be from, you don't say, okay, I'm not going to teach you about God until you're able to learn Mor Nevuchim. There's a, that's a very different method than someone who's coming from a lack of belief. Someone who's coming from a place where they don't believe, so they have to be introduced differently. They have to be brought in through the intellect. Whereas when we're trying to figure out what's the ideal method of chinuch, the answer is we don't start with the intellect. We start with the heart.
But that's also, I feel, just out of necessity, meaning you can't go to a third grader and, you know, give a shiur like this and be like, oh, now you're going to be a mom in our class.
Okay, it's out of necessity, but it's also going to produce something that's powerfully much more powerful. That's probably going to be...
But I also think that's just due because that's what you're growing up with. That's why I'm trying to say, like, I don't think that... I think that's trying to talk about someone who's not necessarily a mom and who's coming from this and you have to... Because, like, I guess I'm coming from the same objection. Why would you need to talk about teaching proofs to someone who's already a mom and why would they need the proofs?
And so that's exactly what we're trying to answer. That's exactly what the Rambam's saying, why it's valuable to have these proofs even if you already are a mammon. Of course it's valuable for someone who isn't a mammon. Then it's a necessity. Then there's no question, right? There's no question why you need proof if you don't believe. The question that we're trying to answer is a more fundamental question, which is what value is there if you already do believe? That's our question. You don't need to ask the question if you don't believe. Okay. We're going to do this quickly because I do want to get to today's topic. Yes?
I don't know if I'm understanding this correctly, but do the Or HaChaim or other similar figures, they say like maybe like the most basic root of belief should not be rational, should not be something that's necessarily based in evidence?
What he was...
speaking about specifically what, like, why one should believe, like what that root base should be?
You're asking... what's the epistemological basis for belief, if not a rational argument, right? Let's wait on that topic. No. It's an important question to answer, and I think we should focus on that, and we're going to work on that next week with the Kuzari. I wasn't sure if we're going to do that, but. Maybe we should. Yes.
Just the sources that Rebbe was quoting. Are they referring to philosophical proofs of God specifically, and not proofs for the Torah? Are they also referring to proofs for the Torah?
The focus they happen to. I mean, I think they're. It's relevant to both.
I mean, some yes, some no. That's what it seems. The Chassid Yavetz maybe would be referring to. It's a very relevant question.
It's referring to both. right?
Rabbi Chanan might be referring to only false half of Bruce God. Maybe he would agree that the Kuzari is.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's go on. So, earlier, yes.
When you speak about proofs, so, the argument, are you only meaning in the sense of, like, proofs coming from, like, axioms or first arguments? Or is an argument trying to say something like what the Bazaar says that's also a proof?
We'll talk about that. Good question. That's what Hashem, we'll get there. Okay.
Are there any extra source sheets?
What?
Are there any extra source sheets?
Are there any extra source sheets? Looks like we're out. Okay. you could share with people sitting next to you. Okay. We've, in the previous weeks, we saw the Medrash that talked about how Avraham Avinu came to a Hakar of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We saw Rambam and others develop those types of proofs in the Mar Nevuchim, in the Chovos Halavavos. And the question is, how do those relate to our world? Rambam's proofs, as we noted, at least the formulations, are describing a Aristotelian conception of the universe, which is very, very different than our conception of the universe. And really, modernity has challenged the enterprise of seeking proofs of this nature for two reasons. The first is that there were a number of, especially 18th century thinkers, Hume and Kant, among others, who challenged the viability of the cosmological argument, at least the way that the Rishonim or the medieval scholastics that set up the cosmological argument, which is based off of certain presumptions of causation. And second of all, because contemporary science claims to have offered alternative solutions. Evolution is a theory that would explain the existence of life without resorting to God. And therefore, for these two reasons, there have been those who questioned the viability of the types of proofs that the Rambam and others offer, and whether, in fact, there's any value or possibility of finding proof today. For more than a century, I think there have been those who study the philosophy of religion have really debated this point. What should be the epistemological basis for belief in God? And the first school of thought, which we'll talk about today, de-emphasizes and sometimes outright rejects the notion of looking for proof. It's both inappropriate, it won't succeed, and it's unnecessary. Now, it's important to remember that there were those who rejected the idea of looking for proof, dismissed the idea, well before these proofs were quote-unquote disproven, as, again, we'll work on next week. The Kuzari minimizes the value of proof. He doesn't think it's an important part of faith. And that was even in a world when the proofs were considered ironclad and not challenged. So it's not simply that the de-emphasis on proof is a reaction to the weakening of the power of the proof. There are good reasons, and there were many great Jewish thinkers who rejected proof, even when the proofs were valid. But in addition, Lemaisa, the classical types of proofs, those in the first school of thought argue, are no longer relevant, and therefore we have to focus, emphasize other aspects when we talk about emunah. The Rav, maybe we'll have a chance, I don't know if we'll get to it today, was really of this school of thought. But other contemporary thinkers continue to emphasize proof. Now, many have scaled down the claims from having proofs that yield certainty to amassing a cumulative effect or weight or converging lines of evidence where they show there's a high degree of probability or it's the most reasonable conclusion that God exists or the like. But fundamentally, they continue to argue that even in today's world, we can talk about a cosmological argument for the existence of God and the like. So let's start with the first school of thought, and then we'll turn to the second. So in terms of the first school of thought, those who say proof is no longer possible or not relevant, it's important to remember that it is, or it may be, rational to believe in something, even if it cannot be proven. The Rambam himself in Mor Nevuchim, which you have here, your first source in the sheets that you got today, emphasizes the importance of accepting that some true ideas can be proven, some cannot be proven, and to be honest about what can and can't be proven. If you admit the doubt and do not persuade yourself to believe that there's a proof for things that cannot be demonstrated, and again, truth is, to really appreciate this, you have to read the whole chapter. But the Rambam writes, we have to acknowledge our intellectual limitations, and while the Rambam himself felt that the existence of God can be proven, there are things that we should believe as true, even if they can't be proven. And so, emunah, according to this first school of thought, is in the modern world, is one such example. There are means by which a person should come to belief and faith. And again, we'll talk about this more next week, maybe a little bit this week. Now, again, I should also stress, it's not like these those in this school of thought believe that science or philosophy has refuted religion in any way. There's nothing in science or philosophy at all that disproves the existence of God. Nobody reasonable will claim that. It's simply that it doesn't make sense to turn to science and philosophy as we once did to prove the existence of God. So, again, for example, just we're referring to the Rav, even though the Rav felt that looking for proof in a more medieval way doesn't make any sense anymore. He writes, and here's just one of many quotes we could have cited, "I've never been seriously troubled by the problem of evolution on both cosmic and organic levels." And again, hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about why he wasn't troubled by this, either this week or next week. The second school of thought, which is really what I wanted to focus on today, maintains that science can still serve as the basis for a belief, and certainly as a part of something much bigger, but still plays a very important role in faith. And even though the types of straightforward syllogistic arguments that you find in the Rishonim may no longer hold water as they formulated it, the basic ideas that they set out are still true. The cosmological argument is not dead, even if it needs a little bit of reformulation. And the truth is that you could even make the opposite case, that instead of saying that modern physics dispenses for the need for God, actually, if anything, it depends upon the existence of God, because modern physics no longer presumes the eternity of matter, that the universe or matter always existed, but there's powerful scientific evidence that there was a beginning, whatever you want to call it, the Big Bang or the like. And once you accept that there is a beginning, so you have to start asking yourself some basic questions, which is, what started it all? What triggered it all? Why does anything exist whatsoever? Why should there be matter? What started the Big Bang? Now, there are many questions that science doesn't answer. And for the most part, science doesn't seek to answer these questions. They're beyond the purview of science. But for someone who is seeking the ultimate truth, they're very important questions to ask. And these are answers that science doesn't have an answer for. Why should anything exist? What started it all? What began? Talk about evolution. Evolution doesn't address these questions. It seeks to explain how life on Earth could naturally evolve from simpler building blocks, but it doesn't consider the root of existence, why anything should exist, why there should be a world, why should there be these simpler building blocks that evolve to form life. Now, to be fair, there is a response to this question. Generally speaking, the response is something along the lines of, well, you're right, but the universe is part of something bigger. So maybe there's a multiverse. It's true, there does seem to be a beginning to our universe, and there therefore must have been something that triggered it, but maybe it's just part of something even bigger. Now, this really just pushes the can down the road, because you still have to ask, well, what's the source of the ingenious laws that allows universe to pop into existence? And why should anything exist at all? And another relevant point is that hypothesizing about the existence of other universes where there's no evidence for their existence, there's no way to, as far as we can tell, certainly in the foreseeable scientific future, to see any evidence to prove or disprove or anything like that. In other words, just simply saying, well, you know, why did it start? Maybe there's something else that existed before then that started it all. But that's not really, again, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm not qualified to say this, but that's not science. It's not empirical in any way. So it's important to remember. Now, whether or not this proves the existence of God or not is a different question. But it's very important to remember that there are a lot of very basic, fundamental questions that science doesn't claim to be able to answer. And these are those fundamental questions. Moreover, even if you were to get over those humps, there's still many things that science really has a great deal of difficulty or perhaps no way of explaining. There's no real, as far as I could tell, way to explain for the possibility of how life can evolve from non-life, from animate or life could evolve from inanimate objects. You know, the closest conceptual model for that is the formation of amino acids under certain conditions. There's certainly no theory to explain the evolution of consciousness or even the nature of consciousness and the like. So there are a lot of things that science, as I said, doesn't have answers to, and that a reasonable person, I think, would say that the answer is God. Now, there are those who reject this type of argument. Richard Dawkins, a very famous atheist, calls this, I think there were those who said it beforehand, but the God of the gaps argument. And they say that, look, you know, you're saying what's God? Wherever there's a gap in science, you'll just call that God. But since science is progressing so rapidly, surely all those gaps will be filled in, and then there'll be no more room for God. He has a lot of emunah, just not... but the truth is that I don't think that's such a strong point. These gaps that we've been talking about aren't like minor holes, you know. How does it go from this protein to this? These are very basic, fundamental questions about which there isn't any direction in science to being able to answer. Now, again, one response that somebody could say is, well, look, you know, we have a lot of questions that can't be answered, and we're just saying, well, you know, there was another universe that existed before this universe that caused the existence of this universe, and you're just saying, well, it's God, right? God started it. So what's the difference between the two? There are a number of ways one can address that challenge. I'll show you one interesting one from the Chazon Ish, and then we'll consider some others. So this is the third source you have over on your sheets. And the Chazon Ish basically argues that, you know, after showing that God's existence is necessary, because nothing else could account for the existence of our universe, he asks that basically what would then account for the existence of God, right? Okay, so there's no way to account for the universe except for God. So why does God exist? Who created God? And so take a look. Let's look at what the Chazon Ish answers. V'yesh mi balei dimyon hashoa leman arviach im naskim sheyesh la'olam mamzi acharei she'ninu muchrachim lehaskim sheborei olam nimtza ve'en eis lehaschalaso u'metziuso nitzchis v'harei hadra koshil adochta eich efshar Lenimtza below Havaya. Right, that's the question. Richard Dawkins calls that the ultimate 747 gambit, or something like that. Anyway, Aval ein ledimyon bina ki kol nimtza sheyesh lo midah v'ketzev orech v'shatach anu mitzayrim b'da'ateinu ha'adro. When you're talking about something that's physical, so we could imagine its non-existence. And therefore, anything, any existence of that sort, there has to be a cause or a reason for their existence, because they could not exist. There must have been a beginning. What brought this into existence? There are things that don't have any physical properties. They don't have height or weight or anything of that sort. They necessarily exist. And we can't conceive of their non-existence. Hamuskalos. Ah, we're back to that 2 weeks in a row. Kimo, for example, 2 times 2 is 4. In other words, it's a reality. It can't not be true. It's a necessary truth. That actually is an interesting question in terms of the philosophy of mathematics and the like, but not for now. Ukimo hamuskal shalachson odef al orech al haorech. The kiyote bahen mina muskalos she'en lemuskal musagim mi musage guf vein eis lemetziusan velo noldu me'olam velo yamusu li'olam. In other words, something that's a necessary truth, like 2 times 2 is 4, is something that wasn't created. It's something that was always the case. So there's no reason to ask about such a thing. Well, what brought it into existence? Because it always existed. It didn't need to be created. It's a necessary truth. Ve'en mitziusan nirgashos. Right? We don't see them or feel them or touch them. Rak v'nishama shenitan l'adam l'avinu l'askil v'nimtza kazeh hu mitziuso yizborach. Manti kol hanimtzaim. Ach ein li yitzur shum musag mimahuso. Ki hu yizborach bal kol. Bal koach uval bechira yodea kol yitzura v'yodea ma'asehem v'yodea tzorkam v'chol hamisrachesh imahem. Umehaves kol hanaseh b'chol olamos b'irtzono yisbarach ki kol hanaseh b'irtzono yisbarach kshura ve'en kol pe'ula zulaso yisbarach. Another, I know there are questions, I see them. Well, hopefully we'll, I'd like to finish up a couple more points related, and then Blina Der, I'll take your questions. Another response, I think, to the God of the Gaps objection was formulated. This is in a number of thinkers. Here's a this is from a New York Times interview of Dr. Alvin Plantinga, and he made a good point. Some atheists seem to think that a sufficient reason for atheism is the fact, as they say, that we no longer need God to explain natural phenomena. Lightning and thunder, for example. We now have science. As a justification for atheism, this is pretty lame. We no longer need the moon to explain or account for lunacy. It hardly follows that belief in the non-existence of the moon, amoonism, is justified. Amoonism on this ground would be sensible only if the sole ground for belief in the existence of the moon was its explanatory power with respect to lunacy. And even so, the justified attitude would be agnosticism with respect to the moon, not amoonism. The same thing goes with the belief in God. Atheism on this sort of basis could be justified only if the explanatory power of theism were the only reason for belief in God. And even then, agnosticism would be the justified attitude, not atheism. Now, that's not to say, for a moment, going back to our questions, that the questions that we asked, why does anything exist? How do we explain the existence of consciousness or life? None of these would seem to be possible without God. Definitively or conclusively prove the existence of God. If we go back to that article from Plantinga, he writes that there are a large number of what he calls pretty good theistic arguments, 20 or 30 arguments, none of which is conclusive, but the way he puts it as, when you take the whole bunch together, it's as strong as any philosophical argument you'll ever get. And while perhaps they lack the elegance of the types of the syllogistic proofs that the medievals set up, they are still very powerful. Now, let's say a person says, yeah, but I want definitive proof. Anything less than definitive proof will leave me an agnostic. So if you can't, you could make 25 or 30 good arguments. That's not, I want one definitive proof. So I think we would respond in a couple of ways. Number one is the person who is making this claim really being epistemologically consistent? Is that the attitude that they have with respect to other questions, that if it can't be definitively proven, they're going to reject its existence? They always demand absolute proof. It reminds me of a certain quote from Rav Dessler, which you have here on the top of page 2. Taus hilachshov shicholem lasigas amuna muchlatas like echakiros sichlios ufilosofia. Hare asechel neshuchad al yidei kol minei negios. We'll talk more about that a little later. Haratzon matas asechel anshu chafetz. Really, Dessler says very frequently it's the ratzon leading the sechel and not the reverse. Kshadam ponel sichlo beterem his amek betorah uviseses amunaso al kabas avos amunas chachamim. Veroche shesichlo iya hashofet habil adi al inyane amuna. Siman hush en rotzel amin. Someone who makes that argument, it's a simon that they just want an excuse not to believe. Lachen ponel shofet meshuchat shorel lo kirtzono. Hasechel gam mugval, ki machshava miyusedet al tziurim gashmiim shehem mugbalim. And again, we'll get back to that more in a moment. So, to summarize what we've seen so far, this second school of thought maintains that, number one, there are reasonable, if not conclusive, arguments in favor for the existence of God. There are certainly many, many basic things that can't be explained without God. Why is there anything that exists? Consciousness, etc. Number two is that the demand for absolute proof is not necessarily epistemologically warranted, especially in light of the fact that the other options are really saying, I don't know, about all sorts of very, very fundamental things. And to this, I think we can add a third point, one which we'll have a chance to develop more next week. But if you continue in that quote from Plantinga, I don't think arguments are needed for rational belief in God. In this regard, belief in God is like belief in other minds or belief in the past. Belief in God is grounded in experience. I don't know how to pronounce that. But a certain inborn inclination that we have for God's existence. And again, we'll talk more about this next week when we read the writings of the Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Rav, who preferred this type of experiential awareness and knowledge for the existence of God over the more philosophical, scientific types of proof. But it's important to remember, because people sometimes make this claim, that from a philosophical perspective, trusting in that is something that's rational. When it comes to neutral matters, so it might make sense to say that it's irrational to believe in something if you can't prove that it exists. That was Bertrand Russell's famous argument against belief. He had his, you know, teacup floating around Mars or whatever it is, right? That if, when it comes to something like that, if I tell you that there's a teacup that's orbiting Mars, so it makes sense for you to say, well, I'm not going to believe you unless you could prove that that's true. Because there's no reason for you to presume that there's a teacup. But when it comes to something like belief in God, that's intuitive. So, and especially when it's something that explains our existence in a more simple way than any alternative theory, then it's rational to believe in his existence, even if it can't be definitively proven. In other words, another way of looking at it is the question of theism versus atheism depends upon whom the philosophical burden of proof lies. Atheists claim that the burden of proof lies entirely on theists, and therefore, if it can't be proven, it is absurd to believe. Whereas Maaminim would respond that given our intuitive belief, given our experiential connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, given the fact that there's no other reasonable explanation for all that exists, so it is rational to believe especially when you consider that there's so much evidence, even if there isn't definitive proof. So this is a much more subtle point than I think just the God of the Gaps argument. So again, to summarize, those who argue against belief in God are unable to account for the existence of numerous phenomena, such as existence, life, and consciousness. And therefore, at the very least, these things demonstrate that belief in God is a very reasonable worldview. And then when you add to that the fact that we have this intuitive feeling, we have a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the like, the sophisticated believing Jew definitely does not need to buy into the dogma that's found in a lot of contemporary science or philosophy that belief in God is no longer rational. I'd like to add a couple more points, though we don't have much time. We've been talking more about science, philosophy, and the like. Another very powerful source for Emuna is history. You have here a quote on the next page from Reb Tzadok about the value of history in terms of strengthening our belief. Below, Mitzias Mitzrayim Bilvad Yuchal Adam Lahavchin V'Ladas Biru Hemuna Elam Mikol Hanisim V'Aniflaim Shenasu Lavoseinu V'Lanu. And I'm going to leave you. Maybe next week we'll get to these other sources, and I'd like to we'll study the Kuzari and share with you perhaps on a more personal level, why. My personal approach to Emuna. But I guess one last point just to think about before we conclude, which is it's fascinating that science turns some people towards God and in the direction of belief, and some people away from God and towards disbelief. You really see the very same thing in the Torah in a remarkable and powerful way. On Parshas Veschanan, the pasuk says, "Upentisai nach Hashemayim v'ra'isas Hashemesh v'serech v'sakolchavim kol tzva Hashemayim v'nidachta v'shtachavisalem." This is again on page 2 of your sources, right? Person lifts their eyes heavenwards. Tisai nach Hashemayim, and they see the sun, the moon, the stars, the celestial bodies, and this experience of looking towards the heavens is something that brings them to reject belief in a single God. It turns them away from God. If we look at the pasuk in Yeshayahu, which ironically is the haftarah for Veschanan, not ironically, but it has that same word, the same verb, but the opposite conclusion. Look up to the heavens, to the sun, the moon, and the stars. Study science, and you'll come to belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The very same activity. Same words in the pasuk, Sumar Yomeinechem, Tisei Nacha Shemaima, yields two opposite conclusions. It can bring someone towards God, and it can bring someone away from God. And certainly, that was true with respect to Avodah Zarah in the ancient world, and it is true with respect to science nowadays. And the difference really is one of attitude. I once heard a beautiful shiur in Rebbe from Moshe Shapiro on this point. He made this ha'ara. And very briefly, what he pointed out, though, again, we don't have time to elaborate. The Kadmonim point out, Su'um arom einechem is Roshei Tevo Shema, hearing. If you look at the Svarim, and the Rambam actually stresses this extensively in Marna Buchman, that the source of Avodah Zarah is sight, as opposed to Emuna, which is Shmia. Se'um arom einechem. If you listen, if you look at the world through the koach of Shmia, you'll come to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does that mean? What's the difference between Re'iyah and Shmia? Re'iyah is something that takes an instant, a moment, like a picture, right? Takes a second. takes everything in, but it looks at it in, as an instant. And if you look at the world from that perspective, it's easy to come to tefillah. Right? I look at the world, and I don't see God, and so I reject God. But if you look at the world from the perspective of Shmiah, Se'ul Maro Meinecha, and that's, by the way, the pshat in Matan Torah, where you have the merging of the senses of Shmiah and Riyah. But anyway, if you look at the world from the perspective of Shmiah, so Shmiah is a process. There's no meaning to an instant. An instant has no meaning. Sounds make up syllables, syllables make up words, words make up sentences that make up paragraphs, and then you have meaning. It's a process. If you look at the world as it is, so you come to heresy, because there's no need for God. But if you see it as a process, koach hashmia, you ask, what came before this? What accounts for this? Yes, I see the world, but why does the world exist? Why does anything exist? What started it all? From the koach of shmira, se'ul maro meinechem. So then, ure'um mivara eilech. It's really a question of perspective. And that is why, naturally, you'll have two people look at the same thing and come to such radically different conclusions. And that brings us back to the point, and again, we'll have to end with this because there's really so much more to say on this, but that the Rambam says, which is that really so much of this is in our hands. Where do we want to go? Where do we want to end up? Emuna is a mitzvah because it is talui in bechira like every other mitzvah. And the question is really, where do we direct ourselves? Where do we lend ourselves, lead ourselves? And depending on that, we'll end up either as ma'minim or kofrim. So Bezrat Hashem will pick up on this topic next week, and I hope next week is going to be the end. We're going to go on to the next sugya after next week by hook or by crook. So we'll leave that there, Bezrat Hashem.